So let me rewrite that formula over here. So let's say we do the same story again with dimensional regularization. So we have our Wilson action. It's minus f to the fourth, or it's f to the fourth times sum over some operators, some coefficients divided by, where it's a function of d phi over mv and phi over v. And then I'm interested in calculating something, some graph with E external lines. So this is just verbatim what we've been doing. The only difference is that I just want to flag what changes in dimensional regularization. It's a function of external momenta that has L loops, I internal lines, E external lines, and V dk vertices with d derivatives and k powers of field. And we're interested in knowing how this thing depends on all the parameters. We do all the things I did, and the only thing that changes is this story where we're tracking lambda dependence, because that was the one where we did the integral d4p to the number of loops times powers of momenta on dimensional grounds was lambda to some power, because lambda was the cutoff and it was the biggest scale in the problem. But if we did the same thing in dimensional regularization, it would have been true that it's the external momenta and the masses of the light particles that are making the dimensions of that answer, because in dimensional regularization, if we still have that board here, and we don't, in dimensional regularization, oh yeah, we do. It's the thing in the denominator that's the scale in your problem, and that's what's setting the dimensions of your answer. And all this pole stuff is just dimensionless stuff, which we're not tracking. And so the only change in our whole story will be that the power of lambda now will be a power of this scale m. And I'm taking the point of view that scale m could have been a light mass, it could have been an external momenta, they're all the same scale. So that's what I was calling q up here. So we're going to get the same answer here, where I just take lambda everywhere and replace it by q, and that'll be the only change to the argument. Because of this dimensional argument is now saying that it's the light scale that's whose power is giving the dimensions of the answer rather than the cutoff. So I'm going to just now literally rewrite this formula with lambda equals q. So I'm going to lose that factor, which Alexander just fixed for us. And now these things are going to have q's in them. Why is q equal to lambda? I'm just, because I'm just on order of magnitude tracking the scales. And so are you asking why is q lambda or why is q m? Were you happy with the idea that lambda should be m? So. Yeah. So if I had said I'm going to replace lambda by m, you would have been happy. Yeah. So then the only thing is that I'm going to use q instead of m, and that's because I'm imagining that q and m are the same order of magnitude. So for the purposes of when I find an answer going like q over m, that might have been light mass divided by heavy mass. It might have been an external momenta divided by heavy mass, and I don't really care at the level I'm working now. So. Actually, let's just raise this. So we want the same as before, as over there, with lambda goes to q, so the order of m. So just to rewrite that, that means that A is going to be f to the fourth one over v to the e is m squared q squared now. So mq divided by 4 pi f squared to the 2l. And we have lambda. Is there a factor of 2 everywhere there? Probably not. Q over M, the 2 plus sum of D minus 2. Right? Good. So this is our analog expression. And all the words I said before about what controls the size of the answer, it had to be that lambda was small. You know, the thing in here was smaller than 1, the thing in here was smaller than 1. But it could be dangerous if there's a term where this could be negative. Say those words again. And now, but the things that were smaller than 1 now are have the advantage that they don't involve lambda at all. It's just external momenta in your problem are being compared directly to scales in your Lagrangian, and that's it. And so we would again ask things like mq to be much less than 4 pi f squared, and q to be much less than m. And no d equals 0 interactions. And that really means if there exists, then there should be a reason why they're smaller than their generic size would have. This formula assumes that all the dimensionless coefficients we wrote down were order 1. And if they're not order 1 and they're small, then we'd have to track that smallness, which the notes actually do. And so if we have any d equals 0 interactions, we would like them to be small enough that they're going to be able to overwhelm the largeness of this. The largeness that we would get from this if we had d equals 0 contributions from the sum for which this thing is negative. So or sufficiently suppressed. D equals 0 interactions. So let's take the toy example and see how you use this. So, because we know with the toy example how it worked. So in the toy example, so our toy model, you know, our Lagrangian was minus 1/2 d mu c, d mu c. Then we had things like, A. We had, Right, so d equals 1 would be a problem too. But the argument for so the argument against there being a d equals 1 thing, normally you don't have d equals 1 things, although that can fail. The reason that you don't normally have d equals 1 is that in a Lorentz invariant theory anyway, the derivatives all have to be contracted in a Lorentz invariant way. And so that means that you're always contracting them with the metric, which has 2 indices, or the Levi-Civita symbol, which has 4 indices, but they all have an even number of indices. So you typically get even numbers of derivatives all the time. So that doesn't mean it's impossible. You can design a theory with a vector field in it or something where you are using a non-derivative thing to make to contract with derivatives to get something Lorentz invariant. And in that case, you would have to worry about this kind of the d equals 1 terms.
Does that become an issue for Dirac field? Like where you're contracting with a gamma metric?
In the Dirac fields, we have to count things a little bit differently. You know, when we and I think actually in one of these, in the there's a set of lecture notes. The one with gravity does the Dirac field too. In principle, it's true that you can have an odd number of derivatives, but it's also true that the propagators are going like 1 over p rather than 1 over p squared. And so the argument I gave has to be changed to track that. And when you change it, there's a similar expression to this. And so when you get these things that are negative, where this power, once you're finished, is negative, those are dangerous no matter what they are. And just to top of my head, I didn't refresh myself on that today. I don't remember there being for relativistic Dirac theories, the problem is normally again the zero derivative stuff that's the problem. Okay, but that's something I'll check for next time, just to because there's a very precise statement that's the analog of what I'm saying for the fermionic case. Okay, so in our toy model, you know, we had a bunch of interactions, and we saw that the first one was d mu c, d mu c squared. And then we also could have had things like d mu c, d mu xi cubed. And in this, and we were getting things like this on dimensional grounds, we had a factor of 1 over mr squared, and in practice we knew that this turned out to be lambda over 4, but we just had, let's say we have some number here, c1, and here we have c2 over mr to the 8th, I guess. And these c's were, in principle, a series in powers of little lambda. So we know that this that c1 starts off being lambda over 4 plus order lambda squared, and so on. So if we want to kind of apply what we've been doing to that, we have to read off what f and m and v are. And so what I'm going to do is, you remember, this actually came to us from the full theory. In the full theory, we have some freedom here to switch between M and V. Remember, in our full theory, what happened was we had a complex field, which we wrote as being a real piece, or a modulus in a phase. And this was not quite the same C. The modulus had a VEV piece plus a fluctuation, which I can't remember what I called it, psi probably, or rho or something. And then when we wrote the kinetic term for the scalar field, the complex scalar field down in terms of this phase, let me call this theta or something rather than xi to emphasize that this was a dimensionless thing. Then the thing that was d mu phi star d mu phi, that turned into a piece which was v squared d mu theta, d mu theta, plus other things. And so to get this canonically normalized field xi, I had to divide by v, right? I had to define that xi is really v times theta. That's what we're calling xi in this effective theory. So if I had plugged this into all kinds of complicated, more involved interactions, everywhere I had a theta, I should think of theta as being xi divided by v. So when I count, When I make the correspondence to this field, this thing here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to imagine that we're just going to track the thing that's accompanying powers of the field, which in this case is xi, will be v as opposed to m, and then the derivatives I'm going to scale by mr. So even though we wrote this as 1 over m, I always write this as the wrong power. this came to us as it was really c1 lambda over mr to the fourth. What I'd like to do is remember that mr squared is lambda v squared, and I could equally well have written this as being a number, like some pure number divided by mr squared v squared. And that's actually a more convenient way to write it, because that emphasizes that the, I'm not even going to do that. You could have done that, but I want to count the powers of v here. So I want to have I'll write this as v to the fourth. And then if I track the lambdas, then I would have had a 1 over lambda here. So writing it that way, the powers of the fields are being tracked by v. You might have worried about the 1 over lambda here, but that's actually, at the classical level, if in the loop expansion, the classical action goes like 1 over lambda. Remember, we scaled the 1 over lambda out of everything in the original variables, and this is it coming back again. That was 1 over lambda when the fields were of the order of v. And then once we're done with that, there's no more scales left here. And so, but I've got a canonically normalized kinetic term. So the choices I'm going to make to make this describe that will be, so we can use our power counting formula, that one there. And what I'll use is I'll just use V is equal to V, because that's why I called it V. It's in this theory what was normalizing the fields. And what I called capital M, I'm going to use MR, and then since it's canonically normalized, I'm going to use that f to the fourth is just mr squared v squared, because these rules would have said, if I applied those rules there to the kinetic term, I would have had two derivatives. So I would have had a 1 over mr squared and two fields, where I would have had a 1 over v squared. And so then the overall factor of f to the fourth, I'm going to choose to cancel that, so I have an order 1 coefficient, and that's what this statement is. So if I specialize, if I use this in that, then I will get actually, I'll write it here. I'll get that this is going to go like, so I'm going to track, I have f to the fourth, and I'm going to keep this piece here. So the f to the fourth is now v squared m squared. That's the f to the fourth. Now I also have this term here with the 2 in it, which is q over m squared. So those combine, the MRs cancel, and I just get these things become just v squared q squared. So let me do what I used to hate when people did on the board in front of me when I was trying to take notes. So those combine to give me q squared v squared. So that's just, I've taken this term and the 2 here. So those are now done. The 1 over v goes along for the ride. Here now, m is m. F squared is mv. So the m's will cancel, and I'll be left with q over 4 pi v. To the 2l. And here we just have q over m to what's left. So here's our master formula for the toy model. And so how do you use this? So this, the point of this exercise was, you know, we've written down our Lagrangian for the Wilson action. We've included all kinds of possible terms, and there's more to order 1 over mr to the fourth. We just had this, but once we go past that, there's other things we could have written down. And we're interested in the exercise of trying to figure out what the numerical coefficients are. Supposing we hadn't calculated this yet, or supposing that we wanted to work to higher order in lambda squared, and we want to calculate, figure out what these coefficients should be by demanding that our calculation agree with the full theory involving both the heavy field and light field. Then what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to take observables and calculate them as functions of these parameters C1 and C2, and then equate the answer to what we would have found for the same observables for the full theory. And the full theory will give us an answer involving powers of lambda and powers of MR. And then that'll allow us to read off what these coefficients C are. So in order to do that successfully, we need to know how many graphs, when we have all these possible interactions, which graphs do we actually have to evaluate in the observable of interest to know that we're done, so that we know that we've actually got all the contributions in the effective theory that we should be then comparing to the answer in the full theory. And so this is how we know that. So if we're looking at, let's say our observable is C scattering, like it was when we first looked at the toy model. So let's say we look at C plus C goes to C plus C. Then we're interested in the case where we have 4 external lines. So for that example, we can specialize to E is equal to 4 here. And we're interested in, to leading order, what's the dominant contribution to this amplitude in the effective theory? So let's ask that. What are the dominant graphs? So what we're supposed to do is to choose the things that vary in the graphs are the number of loops and the number of times we use vertices of various types. So we're trying to minimize those numbers. So it's easy to minimize the number of loops. We just want to have L equals 0. So the best case, the best is L equals 0. And we want as few as possible, we want this number here to be as small as possible. So we have to think now about what kinds of interactions do we have. So in this particular case, we know that our interactions, you know, we're, The thing with two derivatives is the unperturbed Lagrangian. We're not. That's defining the internal lines of the graphs. The vertices are coming from everything from here on, and so we know that the everything from here on starts with at least four derivatives and at least four fields. So we know that all the interactions. So we, you know, a fact of this theory is that all interactions have d greater than or equal to 4. Actually, I guess what we really know is we know that we have at least one derivative for every field, because we knew that we had the symmetry where the field shifts by a constant. So we have d is bigger than or equal to k. And then for the interactions, k is bigger than 2. And k is not 3. If we can ask, can we have k equals 3? So let's ask that as an aside. So is k equals 3 possible? Or 2? Well, if k were equal to 2, that means we've got field and derivatives. If we have two derivatives, then we know that's a kinetic term. If we have three derivatives, we can't make it Lorentz invariant. We could have four derivatives, so that could be d mu xi, d mu xi, d mu xi, d nu xi. And we went through this exercise and showed that there's nothing here which has dimension 6, you remember a couple classes ago, because these are all redundant interactions. And so d equals 4, k equals 2 are all redundant. We saw the other day. They're all total derivatives, or they're eliminatable using the equations of motion. So then if we have k equals 2 and d bigger than that, the same argument tells us that they're redundant too. That d bigger than 4, same argument says they're redundant. So then we could have, what about k equals 3? Then d has to be at least 3. But we can't have just 3, it's got to be at least 4, because otherwise we can't get, we don't have Lorentz invariants. So what are we allowed to do? We have d mu xi, d nu xi, d mu xi, and then we have to have another derivative somewhere, so we can make that, say, d mu here. All right, so we've got a mu going already, so let's write a, if I write a d nu here, that will be proportional to box c, and then that will be redundant, because that will vanish when I use the lowest order equations of motion. So I could try writing d nu here. If I write d nu here, then if I take this term and this term, I can always write this as being d nu of c times d nu of d mu c divided by 2. And then I can always integrate by parts. So I can integrate my parts, and that'll give me a total derivative, which I get to throw away, plus something involving box C, which is also redundant because that's proportional to the equations of motion for the lowest order theory. So this is also a redundant operator. And if I add more derivatives, it just gets worse, right? So the claim will be that the D has to be at least K, and K has to be at least 4. So that helps, because for this theory, we don't have these dangerous situations where we have d minus 2 is negative. We don't even have a case where d minus 2 is 0. And so for this theory, it's actually relatively simple. These guys are always positive. And then the question is, what's the minimum number we can possibly have? So if we're trying to start off with L equals 0, we're trying to draw, in this particular case where we have four external lines, there's really only one thing we can do that's a tree graph that will work here, right? We don't have any three-point interactions, and so the only thing we can do is have a four-point interaction, and it's just that graph. So we're only allowed to have v equals 1, but we're trying to minimize this particular quantity, and this thing C cares about how many derivatives the answer, the vertex had, and we want this to be as small as possible, so we want the fewest derivatives. And we already know we have four fields, so that means the fewest derivatives is 4. So that means that we're looking for a situation where v4 is 1, and all others are 0. So all others, v dk are 0. That's the smallest we can make these two powers, right? And these things essentially define that graph. And that graph, this tells us how it's going to depend on things like energy. So for that case, A4, the leading approximation is going to be q squared v squared 1 over v to the 4th, because e is 4. We have nothing here because we're at tree level. Then we have q over m. And in this case, we have one vertex where d is 4, so this is 2. So this is squared. So that's something which goes like q to the 4th over mr squared v squared. And so if I've done that right, we know that mr squared is lambda v squared. So 1 over v squared is lambda over mr squared. So that goes like lambda q to the 4th over mr to the 4th. And that's indeed what we found when we did the honest calculation. So that's the reality check. This tells us that there's no other graphs hidden somewhere that we should have done too, which would have been at the same order in the small parameters in this theory. In passing, it's also true that you see when you look at this that the things that had to be small in this theory were, we had to have q had to be much less than 4 pi v, and we wanted q to also be much less than m. But notice that we never have to ask for m to be small compared to v. Right? In the specific theory that we start off with, the high energy theory, this says that when lambda is small, m is much less than v. And so in the full theory, working at the loop approximation relied on lambda being small, which was that m was small compared to v. But in this effective theory, that was irrelevant, right? In the effective theory, all we had to have was we were at low energies compared to m. And lambda could have been 1 as far as the effective theory is concerned. It still would have been true that amplitudes are small. And they're small because they're suppressed by energy over other scales, not because they're suppressed by ratios of m with v. And that's a special case of the Goldstone theorem. This our massless particle that's appearing here is always appearing differentiated because there was a symmetry where the field shifts. And that symmetry is making it have weak interactions at low energies because all its interactions have to have derivatives in them. And it doesn't matter if the underlying theory was strongly coupled or weakly coupled or not. All that really mattered was that this thing was a Goldstone boson for a symmetry. And so this power counting is showing you that for free, that m doesn't matter if it's small or large compared to lambda as far as this power counting goes. Yeah?
I am concerned about the equals 0 term.
Okay.
So in our original Lagrangian, we had this kind of terms, but...
For phi, yeah. Right, yes, right.
After, spontaneous symmetry breaking.
Yeah.
So, the symmetry prevents us from having this kind of terms. Because,
right.
So, what has happened, so in general theory, we may have this kind of interactions, yes?
In general, yeah. And so in this case, what happened was that the heavy field had those interactions, right?
So
and that's why it had a mass.
By counter terms, we can cure it, yes or no? No, I don't know how deep these kind of terms are, how bad these are.
Well, they can be bad. So maybe after I finish this example, I can go back and if we had imagined that there was a potential for Xi, what we can do is we can quantify how small the interactions have to be by imagining that we have a small number in front of the potential and just ask how small does that number have to be to overwhelm the largeness of this when these are negative. And the notes goes through that exercise, but I'll do it because it's just one more line from what we've done. And it shows you how this formula is useful. And it shows you that if the size of the potential is sufficiently small, then it can be true that those no derivative terms can be sufficiently small just because of the smallness of the overall coefficient of the potential. So this thing that's just generically a problem might not be a problem if there's something else that's making the potential small. But if there's nothing else making the potential small, this is saying that those things are dangerous and they're going to typically screw up your low energy theory. And one way you would see that is that generically you get a big mass for what you thought was a light field. And so in this case, that didn't happen because the symmetry stopped it from happening. And so, that's actually a very general thing, that if you have a reason, if the full theory had a symmetry or some reason or some approximate symmetry where there was a reason why the potential might be small might be that there's not an exact symmetry, but maybe there's an approximate symmetry for which this is the Goldstone boson. So then this thing won't be massless, but it'll be light, and it'll be light because there's almost a symmetry there, and in the limit that the symmetry was exact, this thing had to be massless. So in that case, what'll happen is that the potential will be there, but it'll be proportional to the symmetry breaking parameters in the full theory. And so the effective theory, that'll show up that there's a systematic, everything that's not involving a derivative of C will have the small parameter instead of the derivative. And then it's either the derivative or the small parameter that keeps these things small, and then the whole thing goes through. So it typically is true that you need something like that, some understanding as to why those dangerous terms were not present in the effective theory. Otherwise, they're a problem. I think you had your hand up first.
So if you did have those terms appearing in your effective field theory, would that mean that the more general theory that you started with doesn't have a low energy approximation?
Generically, yeah. That's the usual situation is you just take some random theory that has scalars in it. Those scalars typically are heavy, so then they're just not in the light theory. And so that when you actually find the low energy limit, you don't have this problem because the field that would have had the non-derivative interactions isn't there. Because one of its non-derivative interactions would have been its mass, and that mass was huge, and that's why it wasn't light. So then you shouldn't have kept it in the low energy theory. So that's just saying that the kinds of, another way of saying it is that the particles that have these dangerous interactions are usually not in the low energy theory because they're things that are actually difficult to make light. Unless something special has been done in the full theory. Yeah. And so that's a useful clue. That means that if you're looking at a world where you do have one of those light particles, it means that whatever's going on at high energies isn't arbitrary. It's one of those special things that makes these things light. And so then you can kind of try to work backwards to see what it would have been. As far as the statement that these Goldstone bosons are weakly interacting doesn't rely on that, yeah.
But there is a factor of lambda
in the full theory. So in the full theory, the thing is that the thing about the Goldstone bosons is that there's many theories that could have given you a Goldstone boson, and all this low energy theory knows is it's a Goldstone boson. It doesn't know which theory it came from. So we had a specific high energy theory in mind where we knew that the mass was light compared to V, but we could have imagined making some other theory that happens to have a Goldstone boson in it because we had a symmetry, but it wasn't the one that we looked at. And the effective theory of that Goldstone boson has to look like this because this is the most general thing we can possibly have for a scalar field that has a shift symmetry. Yeah. Because that was the rules I used to write this Lagrangian down. So I wrote down the most general thing that was local. It involved a scalar field, but the scalar field had to always be differentiated because it had a symmetry where it shifted. And then I just started writing down arbitrary scales in front of all the terms, with the rule being that the fields were suppressed by V and the derivatives were suppressed by M. And that alone was sufficient to say that the interactions were this size. And so in particular, at low energies, they're always small, as long as the energy is small compared to V and M. But nothing ever said that M had to be small compared to V in that argument. And so if you had a different ultraviolet completion, which had a Goldstone boson, but where it was true that lambda was large, you'd still have the same effective theory because the effective theory, the things that you'd use to define the effective theory are the same things. It's the same symmetry, the same field content. The numbers would be different. The C1 and the C2 and the C3 would be different. It'd be hard to calculate those in the full theory. Because you wouldn't have this nice series in lambda. It would be hard to calculate the coefficients in the effective theory from the full theory if the full theory was strongly interacting. That would be hard. So the prediction that C1 was lambda over 4 plus small things would be, we wouldn't know. It's just something, and we'd have to do some lattice calculation to figure out what it is. Right. The largeness of lambda would be complicating the ability to predict these Cs simply from the full theory, but it's not affecting at all the statement that these things are weakly interacting at low energies. So that's an example of how the effective theory is telling you something which would have been hard to know otherwise. It's just saying that since you know it exists, it's telling you right away that these bosons are going to be weakly interacting as long as you're at low energies, regardless of whether or not they're made out of something strongly interacting. Or there's no lambdas. It's just Q over 4 pi V or Q over M. Yeah. Yeah. And so in particular, pions are supposed to be Goldstone bosons that were built out of strongly interacting things. And they interact weakly compared to many nuclear things because they're Goldstone bosons. They're almost Goldstone bosons. They're not quite Goldstone bosons.
Yeah. So if lambda were large, it would only appear in a perturbative expansion when you're calculating C1 and C2.
Yeah.
When you're actually doing the effective theory, lambda is never going to show up. If you were to be calculating Feynman diagrams, you wouldn't have to. It wouldn't be an expansion in lambda.
Right. Okay. And so in the argument I gave you, I assumed that all these C's were kind of order one and they weren't big, right? You could start ruining my argument by saying, supposing that C2 is 10 to the 5 or something like that. Because then you'd have to start worrying, well, is that C2 being large going to start? If I start now calculating the running of the various coupling constants, does that large C2 start making C1 large? And so there's a consistency issue you have to start asking is, if the order 1 numbers are parametrically large, then that could change this statement. Because this statement has treated all the dimensionless things as being order one factors as not being important. But if it was true that all these C's were parametrically M divided by some small scale, so they were huge and there was a hidden scale in there, then that would change how this looked because I'd have large dimensionless factors I haven't been keeping track of.
But that wouldn't change that statement. It's just when you...
It could. It would depend on what the rule was. So the thing is, if someone hands you a theory where they've got large dimensionless coefficients in it, and particularly if there's a pattern that they're not all large, that some of them are larger than others. If they're all large by the same factor, I could just roll it into what I called F to the fourth.
Yeah.
But if some of them are large and some of them aren't large, then you have to start tracking the large ones are in specific graphs. How do they show up?
Okay, sorry. I thought the assumption where we assumed they were all order one came when we started plugging in things where it was like Q is of order M and MR.
Right. Q was of order, right. That's not quite right. No, so that was if these C's in the Lagrangian had all been order one, then in addition to that, when we did the integrals, I was assuming that all the masses and the energies that I was looking at were also the same size, and then that was the part of what made everything Q. I could have imagined looking at energies enormous compared to the mass. Say, supposing there had been a mass in the Lorentz theory, in this case the mass is zero, but
yeah.
If there had been a mass, I could have chosen to look at energies that were large compared to that mass, but small compared to the heavy scale. And then I'd have two scales in the problem. I'd have to be more careful about what's going on. But in this case, I'm assuming they're all roughly the same size. And so I'm just kind of just dimensionally tracking things. But that's independent of whether or not these C's are large. And it's not an academic question, because there are proposals for theories out there where what they do is they take one of these terms, like C2, and they say, this one happens to have a coefficient which is 10 to the 8th. But nothing else is big. And I think it's an open question as to, you know, that's not what normally happens when you integrate stuff out. Normally, you integrate stuff out at some scale m, and you get m everywhere. But I think it's an open question whether or not there exist theories that can give you specific coefficients that are large. And so I think, but it's something which, you know, all the flags should go off that something has to be understood there. And it may be that it works, but there's something to be checked is the main message. And there's one more thought that made me think I wanted to say. And I forgot what it is now. Can't be important, whatever it was. Okay. So this is good. So this actually told us something we already knew. But this kind of argument is powerful because it tells you not only the leading thing, it also tells you what the next leading thing is. It gives you a very efficient way of organizing the corrections. And that's normally a harder thing to do if you're just kind of trying to do it by the seat of your pants. So let's ask, what's the first correction to what we're looking at there? Is the next to leading order. This is normally called the next to leading order, NLO. All right, so the smallest thing we had four powers of Q in it, right? That was, two of them came from here. This was one, because the L was zero, and then this could have been two. So then the next thing we could ask is, if we make L one, then we'd have another two powers of Q, or if we made this thing instead of 2, if we made it into 4, then that would also, but if it kept L equals 1, that would also be something which is smaller again. So we can try L equals 1 without changing this, but keep the sum of d minus 2 v dk equals 2. That would increment us up by 2 powers of q. Or we could say L equals 0, but allow sum over d minus 2 v dk to be equal to 4. These things would both give us something of order q to the 6th rather than q to the 4th. So let's think, can we do this? Because the question will be, is it possible to make a one-loop graph with vertices that satisfy this? And is it possible to make a tree graph with vertices that satisfy this? So this one we can actually start with. For this, we know that all our interactions have d is at least 4, right? So that means that d minus 2 is at least 2. So that means that we can only have one vertex at all in order to have this thing be 2. If we have 2 vertices with d equals 4, then this sum is going to be 4, not 2, right? So that means we're trying to make a loop graph with one vertex. The thing with d equals 4 has also 4 fields, c equals 4. So we're trying to make a loop graph out of this with 4 external lines, and we can't do that. We can imagine making a loop graph like that, that has 2 external lines, but there's no way of getting 4 external lines at one loop using only the vertices that we have and still satisfying this. So this turns out to be impossible. So how about this? Can we draw a tree graph where we now allow ourselves to have this sum be 4? The way we can have this sum be 4 is that we could have d equals 2, and then we could have it twice. So with v4k equals 2. Or we could have d equals 4. So then this difference, sorry, not sorry, d equals 4. D equals 4, this difference is 2, and then we could have 2 of them, and that would make 4. Or we could have d equals 6. In that case, we could only have one of them. Those would both satisfy this condition, and we'd have to ask, is there a tree graph we can draw that has these properties? So we're looking for something with, so in this case, we have 4 derivatives. So we could have interactions like this, or we could have interactions like, you know, the number of the fields is arbitrary. And we're asking, can we draw a tree graph with these guys that will give us 4 external lines? And the claim is that, well, once you have something with 6 lines, then the problem is you have to get rid of some, and you'll have to do that with a loop, and so that won't be tree graph anymore, so we won't do that. So we have to do it with these guys. And we have to have 2 of them. If we have 4 derivatives, we would have this, but now we have a total of, you know, 8 external legs. So we can tie them together once, but then we're going to have 6 external legs. When we tie the second one together, we're going to get a loop somewhere. We can't avoid having a loop. So that will violate this. So we can't do this with this choice. So now we can try and doing it with something with 6 derivatives. If we have only one vertex, if we have one vertex, then what we could do is we could have a vertex with k equals 6, d equals 4, we could try, and then tie things off like that. That would have 4 external lines. But the problem with that is that, we wanted d equals 6. It's just as well. We have to have more derivatives, as many as derivatives or more than we have fields. And so this is something which could work. We could have 6 derivatives, 6 fields, and we tie these two off to make a loop, and then we have 4 external lines. And that would be a correction to our amplitude with 4 external lines. So this is possible.
Why are we allowed to make a loop now?
And we're not allowed to make a loop now. Thank you. We would have been allowed if we were L equals 1, but then this will kill it. Yeah, you're right. I'm doing the next step. Yeah, so this is also impossible. Thank you. So the nickel is for Alexandra, so you get the dime. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Okay, so far this has failed. So we have to go up one step more. So we have to try and going now to order q to the 6. So to get q to the 6, you know, we can go through the options. We can either have L equals 3 or to 2, and then this is equal to 2, or we can have L equals 1. And this is equal to 4, or we're going to have L equals 0, and this is equal to 6, right? So then we'll, we're going to try L equals 2 sum of D minus 2 times V is equal to 4. That together would give us a Q to the 6th term. Or L equals 1 with sum D minus 2 is equal to 2. Or L equals 0 sum D minus 2 V is equal to 2. Something's wrong because I'm getting the same thing as I got up there. So what am I doing wrong here? 2 with the sum is equal to 2. 1 with the sum equals 4. So if I have 2 and 2, that would mean that I have 4 powers here and 2 powers here. That's what I want. If I have 1 and 4, then I would have 2 powers here and 4 powers here. That's also Q to the 6. If I have 0, then this has to be 6. So same. So now we can go through the same argument. That so in this case, we're looking for, let's try the tree graphs. We're asking for D minus 2. So we can take D minus 2 to be 6, in which case D is equal to 8, and we have one of them. So we'd have, but if we have D equals 8, then we have to have more than 4 fields, and so we're going to have trouble making a tree graph out of that. So it'll be the same argument we had up here. We could also try and do it with if the problem with tree graphs was going to be that as soon as we have more than one, we get to connect the lines together. But if we connect the lines together more than once, we're going to get something which is a loop graph. And so that's going to kill the L equals 0 thing. So then we try and do it with only one vertex. That'll be something which has to have at most 4 lines on it, because otherwise we're not going to have E equals 4. If we have only 4 lines on it, then we're going to have 8 derivatives. So that means we have more than just the minimum number of derivatives. And so then then we have things like d mu c, d mu c, things like box d mu c, d mu c. That has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So I guess we want to have another box.
So Cliff,
yeah?
Why do you need to have, in that graph there where you had k equals 6, d equals 6, why did you need to close a loop?
Because I'm trying to get, I'm focusing specifically on things with 4 external lines.
Oh, okay.
And if we'd been doing 6 external lines, then we could have kept that one. But I'm trying to do the subdominant contribution to this one, which we did the dominant one for. So I'm not changing the observable. So if we have, the way to think about this is we have 4 more derivatives to distribute around here, and we never want to have 2 of them. We never want to have box acting on a field, because that's something which vanishes using the zeroth order equation of motion, so that's redundant. And we don't want to have a total derivative. So what are our options here? So we can have d mu, we can have d nu here, say d lambda, d rho, d sigma, but we have to contract things up. So then let's say we take d nu, d rho, d rho. The problem with this will be we integrate by parts. And I can put the derivative onto here, which will be something which is box on C, which will vanish, but I also will end up with a derivative over here. But if I have a derivative over here, it's going to actually look like this term again. Oh no, actually no, it won't, because I'll have 3 derivatives. So that's, we'll have to think this through. So the question is there any non-redundant thing? Is there a non-redundant D equals 8, K equals 4 op? If there is, then we get to use it. And we'll have a graph like this for that particular interaction. And if not, then we don't get a contribution from this. We do get a contribution from this, because that was the one I was trying to make up here. If we have something with 6, D equals 6, K equals 6, and then we do it in one loop, then that'll give us something with 4 external lines, and we know that these kind of interactions can exist, I think, right? Because that's, or actually, maybe they can't. We have to ask D mu C, D mu C, D nu C, D nu C, lambda xi, d lambda xi. Yeah, that could exist. Yeah, that was one that we actually wrote. It happened to be zero when we calculated it in the Yeah, but the MRs are going to come out for us for free because that's what we were counting when we did the. So as long as it exists, we have the graph, and then it'll be that size. And in this case, we would like to do a two-loop graph involving just the guys which have this sum equals 2. So that means that since d is at the smallest d is 4, that's already 2. So we'd only be allowed to have one vertex. We need a two-loop graph with one vertex involving 4 derivatives. And so 4 derivatives can't have more than 4 fields in it. So there's no way we can do that. We don't have any 4-field vertices which we can make a two-loop graph out of and still have 4 external lines. So we can't do this one. We can do this one, and we're not sure about that one. It'll depend on whether or not this operator exists. One way to see if it exists is, so this is telling us that we're supposed to take a one-loop graph, but to take specifically the one-loop graph involving this one specific vertex. It's not an arbitrary one-loop graph. And so if this is diverging in the ultraviolet, there has to be a counterterm for it. And the counterterm would be something appearing at tree level. This would be the counterterm. So if this diverges, then what we're going to have to find is that there is an operator here whose coefficient will be the one that cancels the divergence. But they're appearing at the same order as they have to if they're going to systematically cancel each other in any way. And so that this organization of how graphs appear is also telling you where to find all your counterterms when you're looking at the divergences that you're getting from any particular graph. Are you talking about this one here or this one?
No. Say for L equals 1.
L equals 1. Yeah. Well, so you're saying that now, so let's. So here I did it with D equals 6 and K equals 6. What I could try, you're saying, supposing I have 2 vertices somewhere. So I have, I'll have to have 2 vertices, so that's a 2. So we want this to be 2. That means that the D has to be 4.
Yeah.
So that means that both these vertices have to have 4 fields in them because D has to be at least as big as the number of fields. So we're talking about 2 vertices like that. And we're talking about a k to the fourth, a momentum to the fourth term for both of them. So then the question is, can we do that at L equals 1? And we can. You're right. We can do that one. That's another way we could do that one. That's true.
Okay. So you do have to go through and do every single possible.
Yep. Thing. Yep. So we have that one. We have that one. And potentially we have that one, depending on whether or not there's a counterterm there. But that will be, I wouldn't actually be at all surprised if there is one, if this is possible, because it's be very unlikely for these divergences not to be zero there. And so if there are divergences there, then there has to be something to absorb those divergences that you'll appear at tree level, and that'll be where it comes from. So these guys were the ones that appeared there. But it shows you that once you're done, these are the graphs you have to do for the subdominant corrections and nothing else. And it also tells you how big they're going to be. So those subdominant, so the next deleting order contributions to this 4-point thing are going to go like, q squared v squared 1 over v to the fourth times, it'll depend now on which one we're looking at. Well, let's take the L equals 1 term. It's going to be q over 4 pi v squared because it's L equals 1. And then q over m to the fourth. So that turned out to be, so the v's go out. We had q to the eighth, 4 v's over v to the fourth, mr to the fourth, and 4 pi squared. And if I trade these m's for there's various ways we can do it, right? We can trade everything for m's, or we can trade it. What I want to do is I want to compare the size of this to the size of this if we use that we knew that this was true. So that we had all mr. So if I trade this, the 1 over v squared turn into a lambda over mr squared, right? So I have 2 of them. So this is going to be something which is lambda squared q to the 8th over 4 pi squared mr to the 8th. Now this guy wouldn't have the same factor of 4 pi in it, right? What I gave you here was the answer that you would have gotten from that power counting rule from that piece. If I'd used instead this thing, then the difference would have been that we would have not had any of this factors, but we would have had more of these factors, right? So we would have had, we could have also had q squared, v squared, 1 over v to the 4th, q over mr to the 6th. So that was, again, q to the 8th over v squared mr to the 6th times the coefficient of this operator. So this was coming from, let's say the coefficient had, the whatever this operator is, say it has some dimensionless coefficient c star. So we'd have a c star in front of everything. So if I put in the lambdas that are here, that's a lambda c star q to the 8th over v squared, or mr to the 8th. And so if there's a divergence in this graph, it tells you that the renormalization of c star is going to have to be of the order of lambda over 4 pi squared times whatever the divergence was. So c star would be of the order of lambda over 4 pi squared, to the extent that this is going to cancel part of the graphs that are the divergences coming from these loops. C star is whatever this was. We're talking about a tree-level graph with somebody with this sum is equal to 6, which is something which had 4 external lines, 4 fields, and 8 derivatives. So imagine that effective operator has a 1 over the powers of m and v that we've been counting times a dimensionless parameter c star. And I'm just saying that it looks at face value like there's fewer, the countings of the lambdas here are different than they were here. And that's because really what we were thinking of is that this is, it's the usual counterterm story that the you know, these counterterms, if I thought of them coming from this particular theory for which this is true, all these counterterms are coming with as a series in lambda. And what's happening is that a tree-level graph with a loop-corrected coefficient is canceling a loop graph's divergence. And so the loop correction to the coefficient is what this is telling you, that if this coefficient were of the order of lambda over 4 pi squared, which is what you would have expected from a high-energy loop, then it will be this exactly the same size as this loop was in the effective theory. So if you have a divergence here that's being canceled, it'll be being canceled by a loop-corrected counterterm for this particular operator.
Okay. Sorry, I think I must have missed something. How can the C star? It sounded like you're saying something where lambda is canceling something where lambda squared.
Well, that's. So if I had not written the C star, then that's what you would have thought. You would have said that I've got something here which is order lambda times stuff, and then here I've got something which has got lambda squared times stuff, and so how can they possibly cancel? And so I'm telling you how.
Oh, C star. Okay.
The C star is actually C star could have had an order one coefficient. It might have arisen at tree level in the full theory, and if that's true, maybe it contributes to some other process. Actually, if it was there at tree level, that would have been. If it's there at tree level, it wins, right? So if there's a contribution to C which is not order lambda, then this thing would be bigger than this thing. So then this will be the dominant contribution. But if you're asking about how do the divergences here cancel, what they're doing is they're canceling something which is subdominant in this term. Because the loops are always coming to you with an extra small factor, and so the divergences are coming to you suppressed by these 4 pi's in such a way that it's a small correction to an existing parameter which is always absorbing the loop. And that's why you could take a tree-level graph and cancel it against one loop graph, because it's a loop-corrected coefficient in the tree-level graph is canceling the one loop graph. That's what you would have said when you talked about counterterms. You would have said, I've got a one loop-corrected value for the electron mass or the electron coupling constant. And that one loop correction is the thing that's canceling the divergences I'm getting in my graphs. But that doesn't mean you couldn't have had a tree contribution doing something else, contributing to scattering in some other way. So you get the idea that this is an efficient way to identify exactly what the graphs are and to make sure you've included them all and you've not missed anything, order by order in the small things in your problem. what's the next thing here? Oh, yeah, so let's go back to your thing about the potential. So before we kind of move on, so where I wanted to go next was it's almost irresistible now to talk about gravity, because gravity is very similar to what we're doing now, and you can now ask all these questions for gravity. And there you have a much more intuitive picture as to what these statements are. What you expected to happen dominantly and what you expected to happen subdominantly has a very intuitive statement. And I want to keep this. Oh, and the exercise we want to go through now is, this is an aside on D equals zero interactions. So let's suppose that we have our Lagrangian, which is a bunch of things involving some dimensionless coefficients, an f to the fourth, and some thing built of the fields and derivatives of the fields, with these scales that we're keeping track of. And now let's suppose that in particular, the things that do not depend on derivatives of the fields, these order one coefficients that we've been ignoring happen to be small. So let's say that this is true for all d not equal to zero. But let's say that for the d equals zero terms, that there's an overall suppression of everything, and I'll do that by just taking a different f. I'll just say there's some other f that always appears in front of the potential. So I'll say f potential to the fourth. And we're going to imagine that this is much less than f. And the question, we want to know, how small does this have to be to salvage the dangerous terms that were appearing here? So let's say, how small these are the dangerous q over m to the negative power terms. So we don't have to redo the whole exercise. All we have to do is we have to just track that every time we had a graph that used vertices here, we have this extra factor where, you know, if we wrote this as f to the fourth over, if we multiply and divide by f to the fourth, effectively we're saying that all the dimensionless coefficients, if I put this factor into the C's, then it's actually behaving, it's satisfying where our rule was for all the interactions. And so I can think of this as being a special case of a suppression of the systematic suppression of all these dimensionless coefficients. And so all the countings of the F's and the M's and the V's will go through just as we did before. We just have to include another explicit factor which keeps track of the number of times we use a vertex with D equals zero. And every time we use a vertex with D equals zero, it has this factor in it. So the correction to the rule will be really simple. So let me write it here. So the new rule will be, let me just rewrite what we have there so I can raise the board. I'll pull off the q over m, q squared over m squared. This is a sum over d minus 2 times v. That's what we had. So now the new thing is we have to have a factor of f to the fourth, fv to the fourth over f to the fourth times the number sum over vertices with d equals 0. So it's useful then to, let's make this sum to be d not equal 0. So d strictly bigger than 0, bigger than or equal to 2, let's say. That'll be the same. But now I have to have this factor specifically with d equals 0. I would get, I'll have a 1 here minus a 2. So I'll get a minus, sorry. wrong. I have a factor of Q over M. All I'm doing is if D is equal to zero, this whole thing goes like the minus twice the sum of the V's. So I have minus two times the sum over K D equals zero of V zero K. So you see what I've done. This is the new factor to that power. And this is the dangerous thing when D was equal to zero is now explicitly written here. So if I just write this as M squared over Q squared, more and more powers of these vertices are going to give us this factor. And so what we're asking is, what do we have to, if this is big, if this is sufficiently small, then we can make this work. So you can see that what we have to ask is, we have to ask fv to the fourth to be over f to the fourth to be less than or of the order of m squared over q squared. And this is a big number, right? No, I've got that wrong. Q squared over m squared. So if I multiply through. So you give me your theory. You have the m's, the q's, and the f's. And this is telling you how suppressed the potential would have to be to make these terms no longer be systematically a problem. And then once they are, if this is order one, if this is kind of approximately equal to, then this factor just basically goes away. And that means that vertices with no derivatives are not hurting you, but they're also not suppressing things. So they're just there. And you may have to insert them as many times as you like. As long as you don't change these factors, you're not going to be getting any extra suppression. But that might be okay. You know, we saw over there that it was the topology of drawing a graph sometimes forbade you from keeping L and this fixed without adding more interactions that were a problem. So you have to kind of look at on a case by case basis whether or not you can get away with this being one. And of course, if it's much smaller than one, then you're in business because this will be a big suppression in addition to the suppressions you already have.
So it means that those Lagrangians are not physical yet.
The which
because
are
not? If V is constant, yes. If V in the left side is a constant.
You're worried that this is actually like a momentum rather than a constant.
Yes. So you know, we can decrease it as much as we want.
No, what's going to happen is that remember, is just the order of magnitude of the energies you had, but it also could have been comparable to the masses you had. So the archetype of a theory like this is an axion. An axion, in that case, you have a shift symmetry, but then there's some physics that breaks that symmetry. Some small, you know, there's some energy scale for which the potential is lambda to the fourth times cosine of field divided by V. And this scale is a scale which is typically much smaller than V in the case of an axion. And what happens in that case is that this field will have a mass now because it's got a potential. And so if you imagine dialing the energy down, so if the energies involved were of the order of the masses, then you're happy that this is something you can satisfy. But if the energies are being dialed down below the order of the mass, the question will become in our power counting, our power counting assumed they were all the same size. But if the energy is much smaller than the mass, it's the biggest thing in the integral that's setting the dimensions. So it'll be the mass that starts to play the role of the power that's appearing here that came from lambda to the power, and I wrote it as q to the power, then it should become mass to the power if the energies are smaller than the mass. Because it's the largest of the small scales in your problem. So what'll happen is that as you make the energy arbitrarily small, it'll be a scale like the mass that's going to take over and become the scale that appears here. And so then it's a self-consistent thing. In this case, the physics that breaks the symmetry is parametrically small, and the effective theory understands that because the scale that appears in front of this is much smaller than the scale that came from the higher energy theory. And so whenever you look at the perturbations, this lambda is going through and making the answer smaller, and it's self-consistently small in the sense that these factors are now are actually small enough that you don't have to worry about them. You have to include them if you're interested in the effect that the potential gives that nothing else gives. And so that they're small, but they can be the dominant thing for some things, like the mass of this particle. Yeah.
So, what is that gigantic factor of FB or F?
In that case, the topology of the graph makes those things not dangerous, actually. That again involves. So let me address that when I come back to you with what the right rules are for the fermions, because that's kind of similar to the question about if you can have an odd number of derivatives with the fermions. And what you have to do with the fermions is redo this argument, because the propagator is not going to 1 over p squared, they're going to 1 over p for the fermions. And so it says actually, you should all go home and do this yourselves, because it's a very simple, you have bosons, the photons have propagators going like I've been describing, but the fermions have propagators going like 1 over momentum. And so you have to keep track separately of the number of internal fermion lines and number of internal boson lines. But you can kind of reproduce what I did. And then you have a separate conservation of ends for the fermion lines and the boson lines. So you have one more identity than you used to have. And so all the steps I made through go through again. And you can track how things behave as a function of the number of external fermion lines and number of external boson lines, rather than just the total number of external lines. And there's a similarly clean story, which I could dig out here. It's in one of these review articles has it, but I can't remember which one. So I'll dig it out for the next class. And what I remember is that you don't have the same problem in that case. That the although it's true that the interactions there are non-derivative interactions, they're not dangerous in the same sense that these would be dangerous. And it's because of the power counting of the fermions in a way that I can't quite remember the details of. We could either work that through now in real time. Or I could just come back in the next class and tell you what it is. That's probably the safest thing. Because probably what would happen is I'd botch it on the board and then I'd have to come back and do it anyway next class. So. Did you have your hand up? Okay, so since we have this formula on the board, what I'd like to do is to just as a very telegraphically do the gravity story, because it's almost exactly what we've done here. And it has a very similar ring to it, and that there's going to be a set of interactions that you have to track separately, much like the zero derivative ones you had to track separately. So I guess I should ask before I start, how much gravity do you all know? So if I write down the Einstein-Hilbert action, for instance, anyone seen that? Yeah, so some have, some haven't. How about you guys in New York? Are you happy with the general relativity, or? You're happy, okay, good. So what I'll do is, what I'm going to do now is self-contained, and so stop me if there's something that you want to ask, but but you'll see that it's really, the issue is going to be following the derivatives in the fields, and it's in that case, there's the functional form of these things in terms of powers of the field is going to be a mess, but we're not going to need it, because it's essentially, all we really need to know is what are the scales that are appearing everywhere and track those. So the thing I'm following now is the notes I gave you before are no longer doing this, but I'm working from the thing. This is the archive one I gave you the reference for in the first day. It's the quantum gravity in everyday life one. It's the GRQC 03-11082, which was in that list of references at the first day. And the endpoint, you know, before we get lost in the technicalities of it, our goal is we want to have a formula like that one, or like the one I guess I just this one here. We want this formula in the case of gravity. So what we want to do is we want to start with a statement as to what's the Lagrangian. So we want to have an analog of this statement. We're going to start off with the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is one that you would use for general relativity, and then we're going to ask, what are all the possible things we're allowed to write down that are polynomials of the fields and the derivatives that are consistent with the symmetries that we have? And that will be all possible powers of curvatures that you could have imagined, because you have to have curvatures are derivatives of the metric. The metric is the field in that case that we're going to be tracking. And in order to be generally covariant, we have to be building derivatives of the metric out of curvatures or covariant derivatives of the curvatures. And once we've done that, we want to know what's the scale that we should be thinking of appearing in front of everything. And then what we'll do is we'll basically, you'll see that it's going to be a special case of the formula that we've been using with choices for F, M, and V, with one exception, where we'll have to do something like what we did for the scalars and imagine that we have a dimensionless coefficient for some of the interactions, which has got a parametric dependence on scales, which is in addition to what we used before. But we can track that easily enough by just doing what we did for the scalars and just imagine tracking that vertex, that factor, that large factor, for each of the times we use a vertex of that particular type that has this dimensionless change. And then we'll get a formula like this, which we can then read off. And then we're going to want to know, for any particular process, what's the dominant contribution? And we want to go through this exercise where we identify what's the dominant contribution and how does it depend on energy. And we're going to find, in that case, something you're not going to be surprised to hear. We're going to find that the dominant contribution is tree graphs built from the two derivative terms in the Lagrangian, and that's the two derivative terms are the Einstein-Hilbert action. So it'll be tree graphs using general relativity will be the dominant thing. That tells you what you believe anyway, that the leading thing should be classical general relativity, provided that something like this and this is small, and this will quantify how big the quantum corrections are in gravity. And then we can go, what's the subleading thing? And in this case, the subleading thing will come from one loop corrections using general relativity involving two derivatives, and we'll have also tree level corrections involving four derivatives, which will be curvature squared terms. And so there's a similar, everything we've done here will go through essentially word for word. And we don't have to redo most of the algebra because it's the same kind of counting. So all we really need to do is translate the action into the language that we're using so we can read off what these scales are. And then we're in business. I want to leave that there. So let's start on that. So let's start with what's the action? And I guess I've got a board here I can use. So for gravity, so we're taking the point of view now that gravity is our Wilson action, and there's some other theory, we don't know what it is, that we did the integral over to get this Wilson action, and if we knew what that theory was, we could predict all these coefficients in our Lagrangian, like we did in the toy model, but we're going to imagine we don't know what the toy model is. And so what we want to do is we want to still know how to organize with that toy model, how different interactions appear in observables of different types. So our field is low energy field. Is the metric. And we're normally going to think of that as being a background metric plus some fluctuation. And then normally to canonically normalize the fluctuation, there's a factor of M Planck we want to divide by. But actually, I'm not going to actually have to do this very often. And in particular, there's a whole story, there's a tangent we can go off of, which is if we have a generic gravitational field, typically it varies in position. And so it's the analog of what we should have been doing in the toy model if we had been looking at configurations that were not the vacuum configurations that were constant, but we imagined making a vortex solution where we have a soliton where the background fields are not constant in the vacuum. We could have asked what does scattering look like in the presence of such a field? And that would be more complicated than what I did because we wouldn't have translation invariants to use, we wouldn't have conserved momentum, we'd have to expand everything in modes that are appropriate to a background which is varying in space and time. All those issues arise if you use a gravitational field which is varying in space and time. And so, and you can track them, you can phrase everything I did in position space. So, you know, it looked like I was using momentum space in an important way. But all I really used was dimensional analysis. And so you could phrase everything I did in position space using the Feynman rules in position space where you have propagators that I can no longer write as being 1 over p squared, but it's something, it's a correlation of two operators, which on dimensional grounds is an energy to some power. and I'll just replace that power by the scale that's appropriate for low energy physics, and the same story would have gone through the way I described it. Because in essence, the argument that led to this formula was dimensional analysis. That's really all that went into it. And in a statement about where these various scales appeared in your vertices and in your propagators. So let's not do that. Let's make this look as much like the thing we just did by expanding around flat space. And I'm emphasizing that we don't have to do that, because one of the objections you often get from people is that, well, as long as you're so close to flat space, you're not really doing anything very interesting for gravity. And that's not an important restriction in principle for the argument I'm giving here, is the main thing I want to get across. There are things that you have to worry about, you know, things like event horizons and stuff, but which we can come back to later on. But let's start off looking at fluctuations around flat space. And we're supposed to write a Lagrangian, which is built from this field and its derivatives. It's local, but it has to be invariant under the symmetries of the problem. So we want the most general local products of fields and their derivatives. Subject to the symmetries. Up there we had the shift symmetry, but in this case we have general covariance in this case. So the symmetry in this case is general covariance. So it's the ability to completely do arbitrary redefinitions of coordinates, which at an infinitesimal level is delta. If delta x mu is some function of mu, some function of x, that's our infinitesimal coordinate transformation, then the metric is going to transform as a covariant derivative of the vector mu plus. And the covariant derivative is something, it's a derivative plus things built of the metric, which the details of which are not important. Because I'm not going to use this explicit transformation very at all. I'm just going to tell you what the answer is. In the toy model, the invariance of the shift symmetry had a simple, the most general Lagrangian invariant under the shift symmetry was one built only of derivatives of the fields. The analog of that statement in this case is we have to build covariant derivatives of the metric are zero, and so we have to build things out of the curvature tensor, which is something involving two derivatives of the metric, and its derivatives with all the indices contracted in such a way as we have a Lorentz scalar density. So in practice, what this means in a derivative expansion is that we have a factor of minus, or I don't need the minus sign, the square root of minus g. So this is, g is the determinant of g mu nu, the matrix. G mu nu is a 4x4 matrix labeled by time and the three space coordinates, x, y, z. So this is that. And then this has to multiply something which is a scalar, the way we've been talking about scalars under Lorentz transformation. So there have to be all the derivatives, or all the things with indices have to be contracted using a metric. So the most general thing you can write with no derivatives that's a scalar is 1. So we could have a number, C1. Then we could also have something with two derivatives. And that turns out there's only one thing we could write down, and that's another number, C2, times what's called the Ricci scalar. So this is something which is just to make it concrete, but we're never going to use it. You know, you build these covariant derivatives out of something. You know, this covariant derivative is partial derivative plus essentially covariant derivative of a vector. Let's say will be the partial derivative of the vector plus gamma nu mu lambda vector lambda, where the everything that's repeated, there's an implicit sum over it. So this means sum lambda equals time x, y, and z. And this gamma thing with three indices is defined to be 1/2 g nu rho, and then derivatives of g. So there's a d mu g rho lambda plus d lambda g mu rho minus d rho g mu lambda. So again, there's an implicit sum on the row here. And this g with an upper index is the inverse matrix to this matrix here. So g mu nu is the inverse matrix to that one. And then the curvature tensor, mu nu lambda, has four indices, and it's built out of the derivatives of this. So it's something like d rho gamma mu nu lambda minus anti-symmetric in rho nu mu. And there's plus two terms involving two gammas, contracted and picked away, which I won't write. So it's the main thing is that this is something which has one derivative of the metric in it, and this has two derivatives of the metric in it because it's got either two gammas, which each have one, or it has a derivative of gamma, so there's two. So it's something, and it's a tensor. So that means that it's something which, if I contract all the indices with the metric, it's something which transforms in a generally covariant way. It's a scalar, so it's allowed to appear here. So this R that I'm writing is really, you define, if you contract these guys by taking the summing over those indices, so R mu, nu mu rho, that's what's called the Ricci tensor, R nu rho, and then G mu nu, R mu nu is what you mean by R. So it's something which is linear in R, and all the indices are gone. So that's the bottom line of it. And all you really need to care about is it's something which has many, many interactions. If I write G is something plus a fluctuation, and I expand it out, this is an infinite series because it's got the inverse matrix. Everything's differentiated. And then, so this is a real mess if I write it in terms of H. It's got all possible powers of H. But every term in that series has two derivatives, is the main thing. So when we organize the interactions that are coming from it, it'll be the case of d equals 2 and k equals everything. And this is the kind of board work that you should be shot for, right? I don't know if you guys can read this in York, but. Because they're all coming from, R is linear in this thing, which is coming from a derivative of gamma or two gammas, and gamma has one derivative. So if I put in that the metric is a constant plus something, then all these derivatives become derivatives of H. And then these become powers of H, but no derivatives. And so the derivatives, the thing you know about R is that every term in it has two derivatives. That's the most important thing. So the way you make covariant actions are you take polynomials in R, or R mu nu, or R with all the indices, and you contract the indices, or you take covariant derivatives of them, and so L would be square root of minus g c1 plus c2r plus c3 r squared plus c4 r mu nu plus c5 r mu nu lambda rho r nu mu r. Let me just write it, R mu nu lambda rho, R mu nu lambda rho, where I lower the index with the metric. So R mu nu lambda rho is G mu sigma R sigma mu lambda rho. We have also C6, you know, R box R. And we have, you know, R cubed, C7, and you just go off and forever. You can. And the organizing theme there is that because it's built from R and covariant derivatives of R, box here means, box R means grad mu, grad nu, R times g mu nu. This one is an ordinary derivative, but this is a covariant derivative along the lines of what I said here, but for something which has an index like that. So this turns out to be d mu, d nu, R minus gamma, mu nu lambda d lambda r. So it's just explicit things involving always two derivatives. So this box has two derivatives because there's either two explicit derivatives or there's one here and one here. So the bottom line is that this has zero derivatives. So this is the d equals zero term. This is the d equals two term. These are all the d equals four terms. I could have also, I guess I should have written R, just box R is something with four derivative terms too. I could have had an R box R, but that's in here with, these are all D equals six terms and so on. So this is the derivative expansion. And so you know that there are scales here that I'm not writing down. And so the question I want to ask is, so what's the analog here of what should be the things that give us dimension here? So generically, you would have thought that what should appear here is a big scale m to the fourth, because the Lagrangian has to have dimensions of mass to the fourth. This should have been another big scale m squared. This should have been dimensionless, 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 dimensionless. This should have been, you know, something dimensionless, but 1 over m squared, and so on. And the question is, what are these m's? So this thing is what you would call the cosmological constant. And so the statement experimentally is that this is really, really small, it turns out. So it's effectively not there. It's of the order of 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth power. So it's a puzzle why it's not there. Everything we said about scalars and masses, and that's a bad thing, say it again. It's weird that it's not there, but it's not there. So we'll just take the point of view that it's not there, because it's not there. And we'll just ignore it and focus on that one. So this one is the Einstein action, the Einstein-Hilbert action. It's the one that you vary the metric and you get Einstein's equations. And there, this thing is the thing that gives you Newton's constant in the Einstein equation. So m is m Planck, which is where m Planck squared is 8 pi times Newton's constant to the minus 1. These are all dimensionless. And then these guys, what everybody normally does is they say, well, this would also be M Planck because it's gravity. What else could it be? So people would often say that this thing also 1 over M Planck. And that is the thing that's wrong, I think. Because if you imagine if you take a known theory, like the standard model, it has particles in it, and you integrate the particles out, then you generate things like this involving the metric everywhere. If I integrate out the electron, I get terms like this where I get all these terms. I get this with an electron mass squared. I get this with log of electron mass. I get this with 1 over electron mass. And so the electron mass here you don't really care about because the electron mass is so much smaller than the Planck mass. So that's something which is negligible. But here, if I have 1 over the electron mass, that wins over 1 over the Planck mass. It's the smallest mass that counts in the numerator. So I should expect this to be the lightest particle that I've integrated out. So if I'm doing cosmology or something, or gravity in the solar system, I'm doing things on scales very, very long in distance compared to the Compton wavelength of the electron. This should be some particle physics scale, which is very, very small. So I would really say that we take this to be 1 over m squared, where m might be the electron mass, maybe. Or if you're doing inflation, it would be the last particle you integrated out before you started doing your inflationary theory. So it's the lightest thing that was heavier than you in the problem that you're looking at. But it's almost certainly not the Planck scale, unless there's absolutely nothing going on until the Planck scale. Because every particle we know couples to gravity, and when it couples to gravity, it gives us this term with the mass of that particle appearing in the denominator. And that would be a really convincing argument, except it also gives you this term with the mass of the particle there, and that's not there. So there's a question mark about that, but it's modulo that, it's normally generic that you get the mass of the particle integrated out everywhere. And the only place that's really a problem is here. And it teaches you that you should be thinking about the smallest mass there, not the biggest mass. OK, so that's probably a good place to stop. But you can see that what we have to do now is we'll take F and V. So V will be M Planck, because that's the thing that's appearing below the field. And then F and capital M will be whatever is organizing the derivatives. And so that looks like it's going to be M Planck, because the derivatives are coming from this. But when we look at things, if I compare the derivatives here to the derivatives here, the relative size of the derivative is coming from M Planck. So we're going to take capital M to be M Planck. But when we look at terms involving three powers of curvature or more, it's not M Planck. And so we have to think that there we have we can write it as 1 over M Planck, as long as we then have a factor of M Planck over the small scale to the appropriate power, which I'm going to regard as a large dimensionless parameter, which we'll have to track explicitly. So we're going to get an answer which is essentially the same answer we've been using right along, with specific choices for F, V, and M. But then we're going to have an extra factor, which is tracking the fact that we've got actually an enhancement for anything involving three derivatives or more, or six derivatives or more. And so that we have to track that separately. But that's the only complication, really. So So the next class, I can almost just write down the answer once you see that we've organized the Lagrangian this way. So the important thing is you see what the argument is here. You're all happy with that. People in New York happy? All right, good. So let's pick that up next week. And before I forget, 2 weeks from now, there's no class. So next week, we will have a class. But the week of the spring break, we won't have a class.